And I find this so very helpful in thinking through the sort of issues that confront us in our day. And the biblical realism is found in the book, The City of God. And what I'd like to do then, and what remains in the time together, and I want to finish this morning, so we may need to go to about 10 after 12 or quarter after 12. I want to go through then the City of God and see how Augustine gives an answer. What is God doing in history? What is he particularly doing in our day? It is typically Augustinian that it was the Scriptures that he turns to find the central theme for the City of God. And the phrase comes from Psalm 87:3, Psalm 48:1-2, Psalm 48:8, Psalm 46:4. The first verse, glorious things are spoken of you, O City of God. That gave him the theme for the book. That's the way he begins the book. The church, the City of God, is the most glorious City of God. We find the New Testament uses the term as well. In the New Testament, in Hebrews 12:22, you have come to the city of the living God if you're a Christian. It's by implication mentioned in Hebrews 11:10. They looked for a city whose builder and maker is God. Hebrews 11:10, Hebrews 11:16. It's also implicitly mentioned, it's explicitly mentioned in Revelation, Revelation 3:12, implicitly in Revelation 21, verses 2 and 10. Given these biblical references, it's not surprising that other authors had used the idea before Augustine. But it's Augustine who uses the idea of the City of God as a way of explaining history. Now, the book is a long book. It's about 250,000 words. It's a long, rambling book. And parts of it are very repetitious. And again, if you're going to read it, I do not encourage you to begin at book 1, chapter 1, and start reading the whole way through. You won't finish it, I guarantee that. Well, you may. I shouldn't guarantee it, but you may not finish it. Good likelihood is you won't finish it because he rambles. And what I try to do in my notes is give you some of my pointers as to what to read in the book. And there are some fabulous sections. There's other sections that will bore you to tears, especially if you're not interested in all the ins and outs of elements of Roman history. And he gets into all kinds of diversions. He talks about what is true philosophy, what is the miraculous, the incarnation as an expression of divine humility. And some of these diversions are great, some of them are not so interesting. What that all means, it's not very easy to sum up the book. It's very difficult to sum up the book. But at the heart of the book is Augustine's mature reflection on God's purposes in history, a reflection that sought to be rigorously biblical and is a well-thought-out rejection of this. Prudentius, Eusebius, and by extension, Jerome. The taking of Rome by the Visigoths provided the immediate reason for beginning the work. But there's every indication that even if the event had not happened, in other words, even if that event had not happened in 410, Augustine would still have written this book. Because by the early first decade of the 5th century, Augustine is beginning to seriously question the imperial theology of Eusebius. In fact, after Book 1, Augustine hardly mentions the fall of Rome that took place in 410. As one writer, Johannes van Oort, puts it, the City of God is not an occasional pamphlet that developed into a comprehensive work, but one of Augustine's principal works written after a long process of maturation. So it was, he began writing the book when he was in middle age. He was a man in his late 50s. When he finished it, he was 73. And so it spans the bulk of what had to be his most productive era as a Christian thinker, and also his most mature era as a Christian. The book falls into two parts. The first part is books 1 to 10. And there, Augustine deals directly with questions of theodicy and about the fall of Rome. Pagan attacks on on Christianity in light of that event. And he also deals there with the idea that the pagans had brought forward, that the worship of the gods, the pagan gods, is necessary to secure eternal life. The next, and again, I'm not going to detail on this on the board because you'll have it in your notes. The next, second part of the book has three subsections. So the next part of the book is the books 11 to 22. So it's almost falls into two equal parts. In books 11 to 14, Augustine deals with the origin of the two cities. There is the city of God, the city of man. And then books 15 to 18, their course through history. And books 19 to 20, their different ends. Books 1 to 2, books 1 to 10 then. The first five books of the City of God were probably begun around the year 412 and were completed by the year 415. They are essentially a theodicy. They are Augustine's reply to the numerous acute human problems with which he had to deal with after the sack of Rome. Christians fleeing from Rome, for instance, had ended up in North Africa. Some of them had been tortured. Some of them had lost absolutely everything that they had owned in the world. Some of them had seen relatives slain and their bodies left to rot in the open air. Others had been taken into captivity. Most distressing was the fact that Christian women and young girls had been violated. And some had even chosen to take their own lives rather than submit to rape. And Augustine, in Book 1, seeks to reason, give reasoned, biblical answers to these horrors. For instance, when somebody, to the people who had lost everything, Augustine emphasizes that while you may lose your possessions, you can never lose the inner riches that are given through saving faith. And then some believers were killed. Well, Augustine emphasized, well, death is coming to all of us. Death is common to all. What makes it an evil is where you go after death. Moreover, as Augustine, he's got an interesting sidelight. One of the first excursuses on the issue of the relationship between on the importance of burial, and he has a detailed discussion of why Christians, if they can, should bury the dead rather than cremate the dead. And I'm not going to get into that, but I think it's a very important discussion, and I'm sure it could be a bit controversial today. But I tend to view the position of the fact that there has been, although you couldn't, I can't give you chapter and verse, but I tend to lean towards the idea that cremation is not a right biblical option normally. But that's another issue. What about, and he takes considerable space on this issue, what about the question, was it sin for Christian women to commit suicide in order to avoid being raped? He, first of all, makes it clear, to be a victim of rape in no way pollutes the person raped, since purity is a virtue of the mind. Augustine is conscious. It's a very sensitive discussion he goes through. Augustine is conscious. There may be a sense of shame that fills the victim. But in the eyes of God, there's been no sin committed by that person. Augustine does not wish to countenance suicide. As he says, he clearly says in the sacred canonical books, there is no injunction or permission given to commit suicide to avoid or escape any evil. Yet, he is prepared to consider the possibility that these women had actually been commanded by God to sacrifice themselves. I'm not necessarily agreeing with it, but I'm just taking you through that. Much like Samson's self-sacrifice. The problem is, and what you actually see here, is Augustine, number one, dealing with the issue with, I think, a significant degree of sensitivity, but he's also, it's rare for Augustine, and he's waffling. because he knows a good number of his contemporaries view these women as martyrs. And how does he respond to that? He is extremely reluctant to condemn these women whom some of his Christian contemporaries viewed as martyrs. And then that's books 1 to 5. He's dealing with all those issues. And in fact, the questions I've given you primarily deal with those chapters. And then books 6 to 10, he responds to the pagans. In the books 1 to 5, he also responds to pagans who blame the church for the ills that have come into society. And he actually looks at a number of incidents of Roman history and says, look, you, Rome has not only had setbacks when there have been Christians ruling. Pagans have also been ruling at times when Rome has gone through difficult times. And what Augustine is doing in this part of the City of God is showing that God never intended the Christian religion to necessarily entail all manner of earthly happiness for its adherents. Augustine could cite Matthew 5:45. God causes his sunshine and rain to come upon both the righteous and the unrighteous. For the righteous, the experience of good things in this world is so tempered by the challenges of life that they yearn for the complete peace and joy of the life to come. Hardship is a way that God uses to sanctify us. We may not like it, but that's the reality. What is critical, Augustine points out, is to realize that while both good and wicked go through earthly trials, the trials have different effects upon the two. Though the sufferings are the same, the sufferers remain different. Virtue and vice are not the same, even if they undergo the same torment. The fire which makes gold shine makes chaff smoke. Stir a cesspit, and a foul stench arises. Stir a perfume, and a delightful fragrance ascends. But the movement is identical. In other words, what he tries to do is he tries to put it in the context of why does God... It's a question that comes up invariably. Why does God allow his children to suffer? And what he's showing is, to be a Christian is not to be guaranteed a bed of roses with no hardships in this world. Even if the hardships are horrific experiences. And he's dealing with the most horrific experiences. Rape. And murder. And pillage. And the bodies of the saints being left to rot in the open air. For Christians to make sense of their lives, they must view them eschatologically, is what he's arguing. And undergirding his perspective here is an otherworldly perspective, which it really sees that this world, even for the saints, is imperfect and impermanent. And then books 6 to 10 is a critique of Roman paganism. And if you are reading The City of God all the way through, I would basically say jump over 6 to 10, unless you want to go through Augustine's critique of Greco-Roman paganism. The second half of the book now looks at the course of the City of God and the earthly city, the city of man in history. And what Augustine is doing here is he is engaging in a... This is where he engages in a fundamental critique of Eusebian Empyrean theology. Books 1 to 5 are really a theodicy, helping people make sense of suffering. Book 6 to 10 is his critique of paganism. And then books 11 to 22 is this critique of Eusebian Empyrean theology. And to put it in one sentence, Augustine sees no central role for the Roman Empire in the history of salvation. That's very difficult for him to write and argue as a Roman. And he loves Rome. In a sermon he preached in 411, he actually says, is this the end of Rome? Who knows? We pray God, though, that Rome, like us, and he's talking about its inhabitants, may pass over into heaven in eternity. In other words, he's praying that God would use this event to convert large numbers of his countrymen. He loves Rome. There is no gloating like Salvians gloating over the fall of Rome. There's no stupidity in the face of this unmitigated series of disasters. It is a biblical realism that still longs for the conversion of his fellow believers. Books 11 to 14 deal with the origins of the two cities. And Augustine spends a significant amount of time there dealing with what characterizes them. Where do they come from? He also gets involved in a number of excursuses. And I've actually got there in my notes how to understand Genesis 1:92. And I'm not sure what verse 92 is. What that is? It must be Genesis. It must be Genesis 1 to 2. 92
is your footnote number.
Thank you. thank you. How to understand Genesis 1. And then his argument why sexual relations within marriage are for the sole purpose of procreation. And Augustine begins by tracing the origin of the cities. He goes back to the early days of the universe when God made the holy angels, whom he says formed the greater part of the holy city. Correspondingly, the earthly city takes its rise with the fall of some of these angels into sin, while those who stood fast in glory burn with holy love of God. The other smolders with a foul desire of its own exaltation. When Adam was created, there was, as it were, within him the potential for adding citizens to both of these two cities. For from that man were to come all men, some of them to join the company of the evil angels in their punishment, others to be admitted to the company of the good angels in their reward. And thus, at the close of this whole section in the City of God, 14:28, Augustine provides one of the most succinct descriptions of the two cities. We see then the two cities were created by two kinds of love. That is central to Augustine's analysis of what drives human beings. It's what you love. Edwards does the same in his Religious Affections. The earthly city was created by self-love, reaching the point of contempt for God. The heavenly city, by the love of God, carried as far as contempt of self. In fact, the earthly city glories in itself. The heavenly city glories in the Lord. The earthly city looks for glory from men. The latter, the heavenly city, finds its highest glory in God. In the former, the earthly city, the lust for domination lords it over its princes as over the nations it subjugates. In the other, both those put in authority and those subject to them serve one another in love, the rulers by their counsel, the subjects by obedience. The one city loves its own strength, shown in its powerful leaders. The other says to its God, I will love you, my Lord, my strength. And what Augustine is doing here, he's contrasting the two communities by means of their deepest passions. For Augustine was rightly convinced the core of a society is found in what it loves and cherishes most highly. This is a very succinct analysis of politics, really, is what he's doing here. As he says elsewhere, love for God, love for our neighbor, is the central thing that God commands. The implication being, it is the most important thing in human existence. Also noteworthy about this text is that Augustine depicts the contrast between these two cities in political terms. In the city of God, there is a loving relationship between ruler and ruled, in which leaders lead in such a way as to benefit those being led. For the leaders are seeking to serve in love. It is quite otherwise in the earthly city, where a lust for domination prevails that creates the desire to conquer other nations and acquire empire. Earlier in the book, and he's thinking of his own of Roman Empire, early in the book he had made a similar remark when he bluntly described many of the great empires of the ancient world as gangs of criminals on a large scale. To attack one's neighbors, to pass on, to crush and subdue more remote peoples without provocation and solely from the thirst for dominion. What is one to call this but brigandage or criminal activity on a grand scale. The description of the earthly city in such stark terms would immediately call to mind for Augustine's readers the Roman Imperium, and would indicate Augustine's implicit criticism of any identification of the city of God with this earthly realm. You cannot identify the city of God with any earthly state. The text coming immediately before this text, coming immediately before this next subsection that treats the courses of the two cities in history, namely books 15 to 18, is an introduction to that narrative. And what Augustine does then, he starts with Genesis. And this is typical of his, again, he's going back to Scripture again and again. And what he's trying to stress here is the city of God in history is a pilgrim city. It's not at home in this world. Scripture tells us, he writes, that Cain founded a city, whereas Abel, as a pilgrim, did not found one. For the city of the saints is up above, although it produces citizens here below. And in their persons, the city is on pilgrimage until the time of its kingdom comes. Given the repetitive way in which Augustine describes the city of God in these terms, there is little doubt the state of being a pilgrim in this world is an essential aspect of the city of God. In other words, if one were to ask, what is characteristic of being a member of the city? You're a pilgrim. This city is no home in this world, but is on its way to a true home in the world to come. And then in book 17, he looks at the pathway of the city of God in other historical narratives in the Old Testament. And then finally, in book 18, he traces in a rather impressionistic fashion the course of the earthly city. And here he's heavily reliant, interestingly enough, on Eusebius of Caesarea. Because Eusebius of Caesarea had produced a huge chronology of the ancient world. And so Augustine then is using Eusebius to critique Eusebius. The final subsection of the book, books 19 to 22, focuses on the eschatological ends of the two cities. The earthly city, and here he begins to drive home what he's thinking, the earthly city is an irreligious city. It is a city of the devil. It'll find its end in the everlasting punishment of hell. The city of God, on the other hand, will find its true home in the unending glory of God's presence and the felicity of the beatific vision. And it is in this subsection that Augustine unfolds his mature understanding of the millennial period as the present reign of Christ in the church. And he is not the first amillennialist. Not by a long shot. And in my own opinion, obviously, I would hold John as the first. But that's the point of debate, is it not? But Augustine's millennialism will shape the medieval church and it's the reformers' millennialism or amillennialism. Now, what then has Augustine achieved in this massive work? First of all, he has shown the Christian life is a life of pilgrimage. The eternal world to come is the believer's true home. Those who are journeying towards this goal are part of a holy community that lives by faith, hope, and self-denying love, and is thus marked by humility and obedience to God. This community cannot be fully identified with any earthly kingdom. None of these kingdoms are eternal. And Augustine, therefore, refused to see the so-called Christian Roman Empire as the eschatological goal of history. Eusebius saw it that way, and thus for him, he was devastated when the whole thing was coming tumbling down in his day. The fulfillment of God's purposes, therefore, does not stand or fall with the fate of Rome, or indeed with any earthly society. It is not the future of the Roman Empire, even if it's ruled by Christians, that defines the meaning of history. This is very important. The meaning of history is defined by the future of the pilgrim city of God. That's what defines history's meaning. And that reveals the true nature of history. The true nature of history is a war between two cities. In this age, though, the city of God goes through tribulation and hardship. Augustine refuses to countenance the fundamentally pagan idea that religious commitment automatically issues in health, wealth, and prosperity. Now, he doesn't use those terms. I'm using a slogan from today. But essentially, that's what he's arguing. And what disturbs him is Christians have bought into this slogan in his day. Christians go through suffering. But Augustine skillfully argues suffering is never simply that and nothing else. Rather, it is how suffering is born. It can either be, he writes, a curse or a blessing, since it hardens and degrades the godless, but purifies the devout and frees them to seek God and find in him their true wealth and joy. What this means then is there is an ambiguity about history when viewed solely within the context of history. History cannot be understood except in the light of eternity. If you simply take the boundaries of history as trying to understand history, you cannot understand history. You can make no ultimate sense of the sufferings that men and women go through in this life, both good and bad befall those in the pilgrim city of God and those in the inhabitants of the earthly city. No clear distinction can be made between the two communities if you simply look at the circumstances affecting them. You need to view history from its eschatological endpoint. But what this also means for Augustine is Christians cannot stand aloof from the needs of fellow citizens when afflictions come. They affect all. Therefore, Christians need to be good citizens. They need to be involved in the life of earthly communities surrounding them. Notice what he says in a sermon. This is a sermon when he first heard Rome had been sacked. He preached Sermon 81, what is known as Sermon 81. I beg you, I beseech you, I exhort you all to be meek, to show compassion on those who are suffering, to take care of the weak, at this time of many refugees from abroad, to be generous in your hospitality, to be generous in your good works. Let Christians do what Christ commands. And the blasphemies of pagans can hurt none but themselves. I want to conclude with a couple of last notes. A key place in Augustine's City of God is occupied by book 19. And in fact, if you're going to read anything of books 19 and 22, book 19. Here, the North African theologians develop the argument, human existence at its best is ultimately social in nature and orientation. And I want to end with this quote, which comes from a sermon on Psalm 85 about the city of God. When therefore death shall be swallowed up in victory, these things shall no longer be. There will be full and eternal peace. We shall be in a city of which, brethren, when I speak, I find it hard to leave off, especially when offenses wax common. Who would not long for that city from which no friend goes out, into which no enemy enters, where there's no tempter, no seditious person, no one dividing God's people, no one wearying the church in the service of the devil, since the prince himself of all such is cast into eternal fire, and with him those who consent unto him, and who have no will to retire from him. There shall be peace made pure in the sons of God, all loving one another, seeing one another full of God, since God shall be all in all. We shall have God as our common object of vision, God as our common possession, God as our common peace. For whatever there is which he now gives unto us, he himself shall be unto us, instead of his gifts. This will be full and perfect peace. This he speaks unto his people. This it is which he would hearken. This it was which he would hearken unto, who said, I will hearken what the Lord will say unto me, for he shall speak peace unto his people, and to his saints, and unto those who turn their hearts unto him. Look, my brothers and sisters, do you wish that unto you should belong the peace which God utters? Turn your heart unto him, not unto me, or unto that one, or unto any man. For whatever man would turn unto himself the hearts of men, he falls with them. Our joy, our peace, our rest, the end of all troubles is none but God. Blessed are they that turn their hearts unto him. I went through that fairly fast. There's a ton of stuff there, but it'll be in the digital version of the notes. Now, any questions before we conclude in a word of prayer?